said you'd be home when I get home. There are no stores. Okay, I gotta do all the up in your time. Oh, yeah. I'm gonna stick her up there a little bit. I got a few small ones.
Well, there's these papers.
They might be
in the middle. There's some more intimate than that. Sure, a little bit lower, but they're always so high.
Mathematics can continue. You know, when I studied on these objects
that were ending,
I didn't even turn the page into the second person.
Oh.
I think there's a third. Sorry, so those men went, oh, no.
Yeah,
but there's on the next page.
I didn't turn the page.
So I had to guess.
Oh, that was
I figured that was a lawyer.
He's a lawyer.
No, that was by the first one. I knew it was going to be a lawyer. I'm surprised. It's one that gets.
Well, you probably did some pretty good guessing then.
Well,
you made some deductions.
The error, I mean, was for some reason that would have caused it.
I know, I was wondering. I was wondering.
Because I had the pronominal stuff and then perfect. That's the pronominal stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wish I had that stuck in my mind. Otherwise, I would have gotten almost right.
Some principle. Yeah, that's good. That's encouraging itself. Right.
What's the first person?
Yeah. Common singular.
Common singular.
What is it?
Well, it's the I form, you know.
Oh.
I did. So the first person common singular. So.
Oh,
you didn't know what that was? So that's.
How could I think? I could
have. Yeah, you should have asked me. I would have told you that.
I knew what common singular was.
Mm-hmm. Common just meaning that there's no masculine or feminine distinction. See, like your second, third persons, you've got masculine and feminine. But with first persons, you've got, they just use common, C for.
I would
just
for lunch.
Okay.
Yeah. I thought it was we. And I thought, oh, it's first person.
Yeah.
He.
Yeah, that would have been common plural. First person, common plural for we.
I think you mixed up on that because we're.
Yeah, I know it. You have to be real careful. And if you're taking Greek, your Greek paradigms go from, you go from first person down, and Hebrew paradigms go from third person, second to first.
Every time we've had one of these types of things,
I went through it a second time. Yeah, that's why I warned you earlier, when you learn your paradigms, learn the positions. Learn what they are, because you can get stung on that.
That's why I have problems in the new and the who endings, remembering which is which, because one is on top and the other is on bottom of the pair.
Mm-hmm.
It goes the wrong way.
One thing I try to do is what I try to do is associate that sound of a suffix with either we or he or she or, associate it with that. With that English translation.
We do.
Yeah. Right. I know what you mean. Peter?
With the field verbs, I thought there was the masculine singular one had, instead of the normal, it had a segol.
Oh. There are some.
There was one exception in the field.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, I think there's some there's some that you can't tell by unless you learn the paradigm which way it goes. And
I remember there was a bekeshka instead of a
yeah on the long form. Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
I shouldn't ask a lot of points when I started doing it.
Oh yeah, we need that on the regular paradigm. to track down the thing that you had confusion on.
Yeah, it normally
just schwa. Mm-hmm. Probably one of the irregular verbs, one of the irregular paradigms. Probably gets us a goal in one of those.
Looks like it was with the masculine, second person. That kind of the keshka.
Mm-hmm.
But I was thinking it was.
You just got to transpose.
The masculine, anytime that the masculine singular was used.
Mm-hmm. Go back to the PL paradigm. Let's see if we can find out. What you got there, John? You got another one to...
Well, it's just on 52 in the reading.
Oh, yeah. You had them translated like they were participles.
Aren't they participles?
Mm-hmm.
That?
Mm-hmm. They're infinitives.
Oh, they are?
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
Yeah, each one of them was an infinitive. Now, there was a participle
at first. I thought it was a participle with a le in the front.
No, the le is a marker of the infinitive construct.
Oh, okay.
And that's what each one of them was. So that was the reason on that.
Okay.
I was a little merciful on you there, but...
Okay, I found it.
But that was the problem. If you'd either had to do something or if you put ing form, that would have been all right. I gave credit for both of those.
Jerundial.
Huh? Jerundial. Yeah, Jerundial, yeah. Yes, Peter?
I saw it on page 261.
261?
In the middle paragraph.
Oh, okay, that's what you were thinking of then.
But on the test, number D, you don't have a test form, do you?
No, I don't. Well, no, wait a minute, let me check. Yeah, here's a key.
This is different. Second masculine singular.
Keshka.
That's the goal is
before
wrong.
Before the suffix of the second person masculine singular.
Oh, it's the suffix that's indicating that?
Yeah, when you have the ka suffix in the second person masculine singular, this is a third person feminine suffix.
Oh, okay.
It's not the form, but it's the suffix.
All right. Oh, okay. I got
so
that.
Further differences with PO verbs is the change from seri to sago before the suffix of the second person masculine singular, the keshka, he sought you.
That seri there he's talking about.
Yes, that seri will change.
Okay.
So normally that seri goes to shawa, but here the keshka
on
that suffix alone.
I thought it was the verb.
Oh, yeah, you thought in the verb form. Okay.
Okay.
That's the reason. That wouldn't be an easy one to forget, I suppose.
That was 261.
Yeah, on page 261, the middle paragraph talks about this unusual thing about the PL, and it only occurs with that suffix. If it's the second person masculine singular form for the verb, it doesn't do that. You just get patha on the cough. Okay, anybody else with questions? Or?
Actually, I do have questions on all that bottom section.
I
missed all but one of them.
Okay.
The 30-point section.
Would it help to let you look at the answer key so you can get what the forms were? And then you can track them down. Here's some parentheses there. And you can make the correction and write down the right form and then check it and see if you can, if you still can't see where the problem was. And then let me know. Yeah, I maybe should have written it down for you. If any of the rest of you need to do that, just let me know. Most of the time you missed a vowel point here or there. You know, just there are so many vowel points, and a lot of them, you know, look like just, you know, you just left it out or left out a dagation in one of the forms or something like that. I took half point off of the dagation, full point for a letter. And like, John, you had those where you had a cough instead of a tau or something like that, you know. And some of you just had the wrong suffix, you know, you just mistook the suffix completely. Wasn't too many of those, though. In other words, I would say in most of your cases, you would have recognized the form as had you seen it in the text. Having to produce it is a lot harder. I don't think we're going to have our vocab quiz this next week when we come back, so it'll probably be the week after. We'll set the dates for them when we come back, because I do want to take enough time with this to make sure that we're able to recognize these sequences. So I think we've gone through this example, this illustrative passage in Lesson 55, page 281, this 1 Samuel 17 passage, where you start off with a hi-yah that's at first ambiguous, and because you're picking up with converted perfects rather than converted imperfects, it makes it habitual rather than punctiliar or punctual. And so we're translating whenever a line would come and take and so forth. And then you make a reversion to a converted imperfect, which is anticipatory subordination, and you're kind of going back to that same situation, picking up the other branch of it, then continuing again with converted perfects to get that modal sense. So he's just showing how these clause relationships are functioning in a real text and functioning to give parenthetical information, that type of thing. All right. The next example is Job 1, verses 1 to 5. And you start off with Ish Hayah, there was a man there was. It's beginning the main narrative, and again, Hayah is ambiguous because we don't know what you're going to continue with. And so you could continue with a habitual thing, or you could continue with converted other types, and you get an actual punctiliar narrative of a series of events. So because it continues, Wahayah Ish Hahu, and that man was, there you've got converted perfect that you're continuing with, which gives the sense as habitual. So you could say, and that man was, or that man used to be, whatever. Now, what's the, do you have the text there? What's being spoken of there? And when it says, and that man was?
Perfect.
Was perfect and
upright.
And upright.
And God.
Okay. So it's just describing what he used to be like, you know. Yeah. So that's the habitual sense, rather than really zeroing in on some action that he performed or something. It's kind of talking about his state of being, and that it was a. You're getting the sense that it wasn't just a once in a while he did something nice, but that was his mode of existence. That's the way he was. That was his character. Okay. And then the next clause picks up, and there was born, and when there was born to him. So you've got a converted imperfect form now. Wait a minute here. Why you do? The yellow. Okay, this is this is passive. Yeah. Yeah, well, see, you got a hirik under the yod. And so you have to take that as, looks like a hofal, yeah. Because it should be passive. There was born to him.
You got
a. It should be an imperfect form, though, because of the. Yeah. Well, consecutive here. There, check that out. Check that. Check a hofal imperfect. One yod. Okay, hofal imperfect one yod. Yep, that's the form. Hope All Imperfect, page 243. It has that paradigm. Okay, and so, but it's converted, so we're translating it past tense. And it's calling this anticipatory subordination again because we started off in a habitual mode, and it's just like the previous example. Now we go back to an actual historical narrative type of thing, where, and when there was born to him, it's just like, it's analogous to, and when he attacked me, that lion attacked me, you know. So he's describing the scene, and then he's going back and saying, and when there was born to him, and he's stating this in anticipation of what's going to come. And what's going to come is the statement, his sons used to go, and so forth. He's describing, why don't you read the whole thing in English there, if you've got it, the whole phrase, so that we can get what is in between. I think it would help us a little bit.
When Kirban turned aside from Abraham, seven sons and three daughters were born to him, and his possessions were 7,000 sheep and 3,000 camels and 500 yoke of oxen and 500 she-asses, and a very great household, so that this man was greater than all the men. And some feasted.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, that's right. And his son used to go.
Mm-hmm. That's what he says here, and his son used to go. Because it's using that converted perfect again.
Can I continue to read?
No, that's as far as we need to go for right now. I may have you do some more in a minute. Okay, so what he's saying here is there was a man, and that man was such and such upright, so forth. And when there was born to him seven sons and seven daughters and so forth, and his herds reached extent and so forth. In other words, he's trying to set the scene for the events that when he talks about his sons, he's going to tell you something about his sons and what they used to do back at the same time. So in order to introduce the sons, he goes back to tell you about how he had seven sons and daughters and so forth, and the birth of all of these and that type of thing. So that's why you see that temporary break up there. Okay, and it's continued by two consecutive clauses. So we continue with that same sense. And there was when there was born to him some seven sons, and his herds reached the extent of, you know, his herds got to be a certain size. That's continued in a converted imperfect because it's telling you some more information that followed sequentially from the fact that the sons were born. In other words, it's trying to show you things, how they developed in order, in sequence, so it's using converted forms. And then why he again, and when he had become great. And then we go to Wahalaku, and his sons used to go. That's resuming the main narrative of converted perfects, of habitual things. So that's why they translated his sons used to go, when his sons used to go. Because that's breaking it up. You see, it's different than what had just gone before. It's not converted perfects and imperfects anymore. It's going back to converted perfects. It's going back to that habitual mode of the way things started off. So that whole section about his sons being born to him and so forth was a parenthesis to the main point. Is there was a man, and that man used to be this way, and his sons used to go, so forth. Okay. And then it says his sons used to go, that's converted perfect, and make, wa'asu, that's a converted perfect, and wa'shalaku, and send, that's a converted perfect, and call, that was a converted perfect. So what does it all say in there, Eric, from the point where his sons used to go? Is it talking about their...
His sons used to go and make a peace in the house, so he chose one. In the house of each man on his day, and they would send and call to the three sisters to eat and drink with them. And it was when the days of the feast had gone around that Job would send them and sanctify them, and he would, and that Job would send.
Okay, now.
And he would arise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the order number. For Job said, perhaps my sons have sinned and blessed or have cursed God in their hearts. Thus did Job all the days.
Okay. Okay. Now, let's pick up there at the top of page 282 in our text, and we'll pick up the key clause changes here. Okay, we have they called and they sent. Yes. Go ahead.
You could translate it if you have a text translated text of the translation, because here we have, and that man was, we have here in the second phrase, and when they were born to him, continuing, and then the last verse, and he had become great. If you start with when up here,
yes,
that will continue.
Yes.
When will the kind of determine, or the other ones would. It's subordinate.
Yes.
To that, and I don't understand how to make the end of it.
Okay. Yeah. Let me look at the text there, and I think I'm pretty sure I can see without double check what it says here, because okay. And it's upright, and so forth. Okay. And when they're born, seven sons, and seven to three possessions. Yeah. Thousands of oxen. Okay. Okay, in the English translation, you kind of lose sight of it a little bit, because in English we can probably follow it from the context anyway. We know that he's giving parenthetical information, but if you wanted to be real literal with this, maybe, or at least preserve the mode that he's talking about here, because we are starting once we get to this point, and when there was born to him, we have a converted imperfect. When we had already started with converted perfect, so that kind of breaks up that situation there, and it tells us we've got something different about this. And it's what it's doing is giving us some information to anticipate the next thing. Now, let's put it this way. It starts off saying there was a man in the land of Uz, his name was Job, and this man was perfect and upright and so forth, and one of the fear of God and turned from evil. The next thing he wants to say is, and his sons feasted in the house each day, and so forth. They used to do this too. And just this is a kind of a periodic mode. But in order to introduce his sons, we need to give some information here to let you know who his sons are. So he goes back here and uses this converted imperfect and continues with converted imperfects, so that what you might say is this: and when seven sons and three daughters were born to him, and when his possessions were 7,000 sheep and so forth and so forth and so forth, and when he had become greater than all men in the east, his sons feasted in the house each and these day and so forth. Right, that would be the connection. So in other words, that whole verses 2 and 3, all those statements about Job and his position and his sons and so forth, are parenthetical information to prepare you for what's going to follow, so that you know that he's got sons and that he's got, and they've got possessions and he's wealthy and so forth. Yes?
The connection I don't really get is the last clause there, and when that man was greater than all the sons of the east, and his sons, and at that time his sons used to go and make a feast to translate it that way.
I think that's the idea. It almost seems to have to be because of the way the clauses are used. In other words, it's at the point when he became this great that this happened. Yeah. Yeah. Because
the whole time frame for what's to follow.
Right, exactly. Just because those you're continuing with these converted imperfects, and then see immediately you go, you'll sense a change here. So you got Wayehi, Ha'ish, Hahu, Gadol, Mikol, Bene, Kedem, and then you've got Wahalahu, and you go to a perfect form. So it's gonna make, you know, it's gonna change, it's gonna jog you out of that mode automatically just by changing like this. And of course, the reason, the sense of it is, you know, you're feeling a transition now. You've been kind of taking a look back to see some of this, and now you're getting back to what your point is. So I think the concept of a parenthetical piece of information is helpful here, because you've got one thing you're trying to say, that's your main narrative, and then you've got some side information that you will sometimes bring in, and the breakup of these clause relations, of these verb forms, and whether they're perfects or imperfects, is denoting that kind of a feeling. Kind of takes you off the track and sets you over here for a while. Now you come back to where you were. And in this sense, it's probably got this temporal idea. And why he especially continuing with that.
Yeah. The parenthetical view is easier to grasp, but to translate it when.
Yeah, you can get by without the when completely in English. I think he's done that just to try to emphasize it a little bit more, to try to, you know, be a little bit more stilted, to try to show you that something has changed here. Because if you don't translate it well, then in English you could see, in reading this in English, you might even miss that there was any changes in the pattern. Mm-hmm. There was a man in the land of Uz and so forth, and 7 sons and 3 daughters were born to him, you know, and you might translate the whole thing as just a narrative sequence all the way up, and his sons feasted in the house and so forth. You might miss completely the sense that was being brought there. And it's not a giant one, I'll have to admit. I mean, you're not going to lose much, really, by just translating it without that. But the fact is that if you were doing this, suppose you were doing an exegetical study, and you came across a passage like this, and you noticed that those verb forms changed. And you're wondering, why? What's going on here? Why do I have a couple of converted perfects, and then I go to a converted imperfect, and so forth, and then I go back to my converted perfects before? Are they confused, or what's going on? Well, it's going to help you to see that this is marking some parenthetical information. And whether you want to translate it when or not, that's maybe a little bit too much in this instance. But it's showing something to you that you might not get otherwise, and it's hard to translate. You know, you might just put some parentheses around it, you know, and mark it that way or something. But the author, the Holy Spirit, intended to show a little bit of a difference between that portion of the narrative and the rest of the portion of the narrative. Even though in English we might miss it completely and really not lose a whole lot in this case. Okay. But you might be really confused in trying to figure out why are they going back and forth like this, you know. Know what's going on, you know. Even in this instance, you can go ahead and translate. Some instances, you wouldn't be able to translate it just as if it was historical narrative all the way through. You'd get really confused if you did. Like this one above, I suppose. If you tried that First Samuel passage and tried to just translate it all as past tenses, mm-hmm. you'd run into trouble because you'd have the lion doing two things at once, the same lion, you know. And instead of seeing that he's talking about whenever the lion did this, I would do this, and whenever the lion did this, I would do this. You just have, and the lion would take, and I would go and strike and rescue, and he attacked me, and I grabbed him, and I beat him and killed him. So you've got, unless you see that the same lion first got clobbered, and then he turned and attacked him, and he killed him, and he was just talking about one lion. But that's not what the sense of the whole thing is. He's trying to describe his behavior and the way he reacted to these animals and so forth. So you would lose something for sure then. Okay. Yes, Doug.
Right. I think in English, do that type of thing. We use sort of time key type words.
Yes. We'll
that's why you put that mm-hmm. man in there. That is a time key type mm-hmm. word that we use for this type of thing.
Oh.
Sometimes you're reading an hour or something. They are when they want to do something.
Mm-hmm.
Background
information, they'll just break it off into paragraphs
sometimes.
Yeah. Reading along, all of a sudden, you're getting a paragraph, right in the middle of
everything. Mm-hmm. And then
they go off, talking
about something, and so it's like, time, something.
Sure.
Like,
to bring you up to a certain
point to understand what's going to follow. You got to just kind of get it.
Excuse me.
Paragraph came
unexpected. Mm-hmm. You know. And like I say, we even do that in testimonies and things like that, too, where we realize that what we're about to say, they're not going to be able to follow unless I give some other information. We'll kind of back up, and we'll use words that'll set up an intonation patterns, that'll set up a pause and that type of thing. We'll start on a different mode, or we may just state a whole bunch of words to explain what we're doing. But in writing, they seldom, you know, give a whole explanation to explain what they're doing. You can do it by the paragraph structure and those key words, like you mentioned. So these are different languages, and you're feeling something. The point that he's trying to make is that there's definitely a sense of change that you experience as you're reading the Hebrew narrative. When you're reading along with converted perfects and you switch over to converted imperfects and then back again, you know that something's happened there. And you'll feel a certain thing that you may have to bring over in English as either a when or a parentheses or make a new paragraph or something so that you can see what the difference is. Of course, they don't have paragraph structure, you see, in Hebrew. It's all run together. But they're getting that kind of pause and changes by these changing in their... They're using this use of the perfects and the imperfect verbs and the form of the was on them for a lot of... they're getting a lot of mileage out of it in terms of setting up context and clause relationships. Of course, they do have some words, too. You know, I mean, they have key and they have for conditionals, they have words for those, but for this parenthetical information, this is primarily the way it's done. There aren't any other words involved. It's just a matter of changing the clause relationships. Okay. Something that's better felt than telt, I suppose. There are formal differences. I mean, you do see these changes in the verb forms. Okay. And now he's going to another anticipatory subordination here, marked by would plus the imperfect converted. You've got why he, ki, hikifu, and when the days of the feast had run their course. And so again, he's saying, he's talking about all the things his sons used to go and to do and to make and do these things. And when the feast days had run their course, and he had sent and so forth and sanctified them, he would get up early and so forth. In other words, when they used to do all this stuff, it goes back to what he customarily did when they did that. So it's again giving some information to lead up into how he is reacting and why he's sanctifying them and so forth and his concern for his sons. And another anticipatory subordination. This is again subordinate information, kind of parenthetical information. It's not really necessary, but it helps you understand why he's sanctifying them, or excuse me, why he would get up early and send offerings. It picks up again with he would get up early. That's resuming the main narrative. So when he had sent and sanctified them and so forth, he would get up early and send up offerings and so forth. So it's trying to explain Job's integrity and his heart for his children and so forth and what he customarily did. But in order to help you understand why he did that, it goes back to the other information about when the feast days had run their course, his sons would do such and such. So you see the why he starts with converted perfects, converted imperfects, then the next verb, why yishlach, same thing, converted to imperfect, and the next verb, why kadeshim, gotta look at that one careful. And he sanctified them, you got an object suffix on it. That's a converted imperfect. And then the next verb goes to a converted perfect again. He would get up early. And that's resuming the main narrative again. And see, notice how they're translating. He would get up early. He would customarily. It's a habitual mode again. The habitual, it's an imperfect form in effect because it's converted perfect. And he would send up offerings. That's continuing it. And then we've got a simple subordination with ki. Now, ki is going to, and in this case, it's going to break that up again. You're going to have it's going to be automatically disjunctive because ki is coming before the verb. But you've got this thing really even a more blatant subordination now. And we've translated for Job said, and this is giving us a subordinate clause to what's going to the. It's breaking off from the main narrative now, and then you're giving a quotation in the middle of this whole thing. For Job said, perhaps they have sinned and so forth. And the quotation begins a secondary sequence. He says type 3A here. That I've got page 280B1. I don't know where the 3A came from. It seems like I looked and looked and looked to try to figure out what he meant by 3A. But that may refer to back to some chapter where he listed him that way. But it's really a type B1 on page 280. Perfect plus wa plus perfect, unconverted. So where you're going with unconverted perfects, just continuing some perfects, and perhaps they have sinned and blessed and so forth, and not trying to set up. You're setting up a consecutive series, but it's a secondary to the whole thing. It's off to the side here, so it's just continuing the converted perfects, unconverted perfects. So it's conjunctive non-converting sequence type B1 on page 280. That's the first one of these we've encountered so far here. Yes?
I need some review. The biggest problem I have in reviewing this is trying to figure out if the form is converted or not.
Okay.
I look back in our past lessons and I couldn't find anywhere where, is there any little key that you can tell?
No, for perfect forms you can't tell, because for imperfect forms you can. For an imperfect form, an unconverted imperfect is just going to have the normal wa with shwa and no dagesh. For the converted forms, it's going to have wa, pathak, plus the dagesh. Now, that's only for your imperfects. So your imperfects, you have an unambiguous way to tell whether it's converted or not. For the perfects, remember, the converted form of the perfect is the same as the non-converted form of the perfect. You just have wa shwa. So the only way you're going to tell there is by context, contextual things. And, for example, the simplest scenario would be starting off with an imperfect verb form and then continuing with perfects that have wu on them. You know they're converted. Now here it's a little bit more subtle. Now you've been going along here, and you've got a key amar. You've been going along with converted perfects in this habitual mode. Now you've got this key phrase that breaks up everything, and you're starting a new series. And you might even expect to go with the converted perfects on these, converted imperfect, starting with a perfect and going with a converted imperfect. But it's a secondary sequence. The whole thing is dependent on the main context. And so it's customary in these types of sequences, where you're giving some more information like this, to go ahead and use unconverted perfects. And that's page 280 there, is discussing that. It's one of the new pieces of information we found here. We haven't really seen these kinds of series before, where you're starting with a perfect and continuing with perfects that are not converted. But this example here concerning Ben-Ayehu, and he is the one who went down and killed the lion and so forth. That's an example of what we mean by this. It's got a perfect, Yaraz, and then continuing with Hika, so forth, unconverted perfects, because it's all keeping past tense sense, not converting the meaning. So you're giving, again, another way for parenthetical information. So we're really kind of seeing two different types of parenthetical information here. One of them marked by key and unconverted perfects. The other one going to converted imperfects on occasion to set an anticipatory subordination. It's a little bit complicated, really. And because this one is a quotation, you see, they purposely use a different kind of a sequence to show that this is a quotation in the statement that's being made. Okay, and then thus he used to do, the thus breaks, it's disjunctive. You have the thus coming before the verb and then using an imperfect verb to get, in other words, you've been dealing with converted perfects that have been setting your habitual mode. And you break that up because kaka here is going to break that up as disjunctive. So you have to use the real form, real value of the verb that you want, the sense that you want, which would be an imperfect. And so you call this the disjunction marking the end of the general introduction to the narrative. So that's he used to do. And see, obviously you're not going to translate this, thus he will do, because it's imperfect, because it's all historical. So this is an example where the imperfect is used for a past habitual sense. Mm-hmm. Right. And remember, most of your verbs in this sequence were similar. They were converted perfects. And converted perfect is the same as an imperfect in meaning. And the imperfect has got to be understood in the sense of habitual. So, and this last verb, because of the disjunction, you know, when you make a disjunction, you've got to use the real value of the verb, as it were, for your first verb. Now, if this last clause were to say, thus he used to do, and such and such and such and such and such and such, and add a few more verbs, they would probably be all converted perfects, following this imperfect, starting a new series there.
Okay. You could take it by probably with one verb more.
Yeah. Yeah. You probably could. You'd lose some precision in terms of getting that more of a punctiliar action. But if you wanted to stay with progressive action, you could probably get by with this, just an imperfect. But unfortunately for us, they didn't do it that way. Yes.
You mentioned how the last thing does used to do. Would continue in the sequence that we would have called smart and perfect.
Right.
Is that a new type? I didn't know that.
No, that's just the old-fashioned, remember, let's see here, which one would we have? Well, it could be either future or habitual past. Yeah. Remember, we had several possibilities for just plain and imperfect, and therefore any imperfect series of starting with imperfect and converted perfect. They can be future, that's the most common. They could be present, of a habitual nature, they could be even past of a habitual nature, or they could be modal, a modal type of sense. And he would do this and he would do that, so forth, where you're kind of dealing with hypotheticals or something. Exactly. No, in its root form it would never have that value, of course, but because it's converted, that's the point. Because it's in a converted series, it's functioning as if it were an imperfect here. Okay, and that's the difference. See, Price asked, what, you know, what the, there's no formal difference, but meaning difference is considerable. If it's a converted perfect, it's acting as if it were an imperfect. And as an imperfect, it has several possibilities for translation, either future, or if it's obviously, in like here, dealing with the past, you're going to give it in a kind of a habitual past sense. In other words, that's why it says, thus he used to do. It didn't say, thus he did. If you said, thus he did, you could just use a perfect form, because that would be completed action. He did it already. But thus he used to do is showing that it was a habitual progressive action in the past. And I think when we first discussed imperfect...
Mm-hmm.
See if you can find the chapter where we first were introduced to the imperfect and were told the meaning of it.
22.
Habitual. Yeah, the second category. Habitual or customary action. So if we see, the first category is the future, he will write. The second category, habitual or customary action. He writes as a matter of custom. He used to write. That's what we're dealing here. Or he will write, future, in the progressive sense. And tense is not explicit, must be gained from the context in which the verb occurs. Now you can see some of the keys for the context. So how are you going to tell the context? So a lot of it's because of these clause relationships. And then the modal is may, might, would, could, can, should. You know, there's lots of possibilities there, too. And that's almost kind of what we're dealing here, too. We're dealing more with the customary, but in some of these instances, he would do this, and he would do this. It's kind of a cross between customary and modal, you know. It's kind of hard to draw the lines there. Okay? Does that clarify that for you?
Say it the way they say it.
Oh, yeah, right, yeah, that's what he meant.
That's what he meant.
Right. But you can see here, you know, because he set up a historical narrative type of context, he's giving you some preliminary information to help you understand the events that are about to transpire completely, and he's giving, you know, bits of information off to the side even in that. You can see that there's a kind of a several-stage subordination here of different types of pieces of information, and it's all done very cleverly by just arranging the kinds of whether the forms are converted or non-converted, and using Haya to start off, and using Haya plus, you know, one series or the other. So it's quite ingenious, even though it does take some getting used to. Okay, so note the correct reversion to the imperfect in the final disjunction. The correct reversion to the imperfect because you had the main narrative flow, now discounting for the moment these anticipatory subordinations, the main narrative flow was converted perfects. And those converted perfects mean that you've got an imperfect meaning, even though it's an imperfect form. And now when you use a disjunction, remember, we talked about this before, when you use a disjunction, if you've been following along in a narrative sequence, regardless what kind of sequence that is, and you use something other than the verb first, you've made a disjunction, and now the series isn't following the way it was before. In other words, it's kind of as though once you start a series, each succeeding verb is kind of borrowing its sense from the verb that went before. If you look at the verb that went before and it's a converted imperfect, then this is going to be an imperfect, so forth. But once you put a disjunction in, then you kind of draw a line between what follows and what went before, and so you can no longer pick up the sense of the verb from what went before, so you better use the correct form of the verb, you know. In other words, if you have been talking in imperfects, you've got to use an imperfect form. In other words, you may have started off your sequence with an imperfect form and then continue with converted perfects, and you had a disjunction. And the disjunction now means that you've broken up your series. So you're no longer going to be able to determine the tense of the next verb based on the series because you just interrupted the series. So now you're going to have to revert back to the kind of sense you want, and you'd have to use an imperfect form again in the next verb after the disjunction. But then you could go ahead after that and continue with your converted perfects. The same would be true if you started off with a perfect verb form and we're using converted imperfects, which is your probably most common type in historical narrative. You start off with the perfect, meaning he did such and such, continue with converted imperfects, and if you have a disjunction, you're going to have to go back to a perfect in the very next verb to resume your series, and then you can go back to your converted imperfects. And that's what's happening here. Because of the fact that you have a disjunction by the kaka, you have to go back to ya'aseh there and use an imperfect form. But suppose there were other verbs following this verb, they could all be converted perfects again. And you just start a new series. Okay, John, did you have something there?
I'm just going to say that it's probably co-co and not co-co. It's a contraction of co-co. Or, and here's...
Okay, co is thus, yeah.
Comments cut too sometimes, so...
Yeah.
Thus, he did.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's just a minor point, but it's probably co-co.
Or perhaps co-co, the comma te in the end...
Well,
is
see, it's found as either kaf colon a, or it's kaf comma cut.
Oh, okay.
A. I'm assuming it's comma cut.
Well, that might be a problem though, because the comma cut will not be a part of a mater with the hay. That would be the problem. In other words, you'd never pronounce a comma hay, you know, as a comma cut. You won't say a comma cut hay.
Well, because
comma cut is a short vowel. In other words, this one of the short ones.
But see, if you take the other direction, you got the commas and the hands, the monosyllabic word, and you got
a... Well, I'm not saying there may not be a relationship, but you wouldn't pronounce it as a commas katuf if you had a hand in it.
It'd be ka.
It'd just have to be ka. Yeah. The first one might be, you know. But even there, because it's an open syllable, unless, you know...
it's kind of part I was looking at that kind of...
No, but I think you're right as far as what it's derived from. But they may have been forced to change the vowels because of their rules. You know, in other words, if they want to make that kind of a conjunction between those two, sometimes they get stuck with their own rules, as it were. So it could have been co-co, maybe, is what you wanted to start off with. But once you put it together, it comes ka-ka or something. You know, see what I'm saying? The vowel points are kind of secondary. And remember, too, that we don't know how they pronounced it originally. And the Masoretes, you know, have got all these rules. And they oftentimes got themselves into tangles. So I'm not saying that you didn't derive this from the proper forms, but the pronunciation is going to have to be with full comments in both of these, just because of the pattern and the rules for comments got tooth. See, comments got tooth, you've got to have a short syllable, closed syllable, in order to make it a comments got tooth sound. If you get an open syllable, unless you put a metheg or something there, and normally what happens is if you get a closed syllable. In which you want to say comments instead of comments cut tooth, they put a metheg on it. But if it's a closed syllable with just a comment sound in it, you automatically assume it's comments cut tooth, and if it's an open syllable, you assume it's comments. That's otherwise indicated. Yeah, I know it. See, the real nasty time comes is when you've got a schwa following it, because what you decide about the comments will affect how you decide about the schwa, you know, whether it's vocal or not. So you get kind of double jeopardy there. Okay, well, let's look at this one last example, and 1 Samuel chapter 1, verses 1 to 7. Let's see. Check it here, too. So. Is that actually supposed to be 2 Samuel? Did somebody check that? Which one of these was... This one's right.
Yeah.
I thought somebody told me yesterday...
Page 280.
Oh, okay. Yeah, okay. We've got it at page 280. Mm-hmm. All right. There was a certain man. It's the beginning of the Waihi Ish Echad. The beginning of a main sequence followed by four disjunctive nonverbal clauses that are omitted here. So you've got the Waihi, and you're continuing, in other words, a series that assume. Now, this starts, the very book starts with Waihi, which means that you've got an implied perfect somewhere before, you know. That you're continuing, you're tacking it on to the end of the last book that was written. So you can see from the way they even start the books, that the way they were conceiving these things, it was continuing the narrative.
Mm-hmm.
I would be surprised if any of them didn't. They usually do that because they're purposely tying it on to the one that went before. And so you can assume that we're dealing with a converted perfect sequence, converted imperfects, I mean. And so we're translating a past tense. Okay, and then he says there's four disjunctive nonverbal clauses here. Let's see if I can tell you. Okay, the first one is there was a certain man, and it says from Ramathaim, and so he's telling you where he's from, and it just uses min, doesn't give a verb, and name, his name, Elkanah, and son of Jehoram, son of Elihu, son of so forth, and Ephrathite. So you've got all these descriptions, none of them having verbs. So they're all nonverbal clauses. They're all, you all understand, you know, the connection. They're all basically in apposition. Okay. And then it says, and Penina had children. So it's continuing the main sequence, still with the ambiguous why he. We still haven't really nailed it down. We're just continuing with why he's. And we really won't know until we start getting some action verbs involved which way we're going to go with this, whether we're going to go habitual or whether we're going to go with a continued historical narrative. Okay. So that's just picking up after those nonverbal clauses. Let me just check something here. Okay. Yeah, that's correct. All right. Now, the only thing I'm wondering about is why I didn't go back to a perfect after those disjunctive clauses. It may just be because there was no verbs at all in any of those. They're all nonverbal. That may be sufficient there. That must be the reason. Okay. In fact, you might even consider those all, there's no verbs involved, so it may just be considered all the, not even considering the clauses, just for the descriptions and all part of the same sentence. Okay, then I'm pretty sure that's what it has to be. Then you got why he, so you still don't know exactly which way you're going to go. Then you have Allah, Ha'ish, Ha'hu, and that man used to go up. Now you're committed to a habitual sense. See, the Wayahi or Haya, whatever, any form of to be is ambiguous until you get to actually what kind of verb you're using. So it says, that man used to go up. Because you've got a converted perfect here, you're getting the sense of habitual. Okay, and we've seen this already before. Yes, question?
I don't understand how it's clearly habitual.
Okay, well, it's going back to the way he set up the rule. Let's see. If you look at 279, bottom page 279, this part A here. This is new information. You know, we haven't covered this before, but haya that's starting leading out certain clauses. The verb haya in a leading clause requires special consideration. And so he says basically, if a narrative sequence begins with a clause containing the verb haya or wayihi, which is a continuation, it's part of a series of the same thing. The real nature of the sequence is not clear until we reach a continuing verb. And he gives these two examples here, one of which, there was a famine in the land, and he used to go down, that's got a converted perfect. There was a famine in the land, and he went down specifically, that's got a converted imperfect. So you tell by the verb following haya, whether you're going habitual or whether you're going with the specific sense. So this is kind of new. We haven't really seen this before.
Always this way, then?
Well, that's the way he's saying it.
There's no possibility of saying this man went up.
Well, you can still say he went up, but it's got a little bit different sense. You see, I think the key to it is that your normal mode is to continue with converted imperfects if you're wanting to describe a historical narrative about the past. So if you're describing certain events that happened in the past, you'll start off with a perfect and then continue with converted imperfects. Because here, instead of continuing with converted imperfects, they're continuing with converted perfects. It's as though you were using an imperfect form. It's as though, in effect, you were saying using an imperfect form now for this, and you would have to, if you saw an imperfect form there and you knew it was past tense, you'd have to translate it habitual. And so that's what he's saying here. Now, of course, the only debate might be, how do you know whether that perfect form is converted or not? And that's, I suppose, the point here. He's just saying, because it's following Haya, because that's the way they set up these kinds of constructions, that's how you know. In other words, he put Haya, if you look at top of page 280, he put that as another one of the types of introducers to these types of clause sequences.
No,
that might be worthy of debate.
Since it's not here with a converted imperfect,
right.
Since there isn't any real disjunction after Penaya,
right.
Now I got it, because now I can see a converted perfect.
Right.
Because it seems like this was just a normal imperfect, but it isn't.
No. It's a converted, you've got a converted imperfect, mm-hmm. which means that you're ultimately, you're tracing back to a perfect. So in other words, ultimately, see, this converted imperfect is equivalent to just saying Haya, the perfect form, because it's a converted imperfect. So it's a, in effect, it's like Haya followed by perfect, which is going to be converted imperfect. So that's the reason for it. Okay. Now, our second bell's already rung, so we better stop here. Still didn't get through it. It seems like I remember from last year, this, I mean, the last time I taught this, this is, we had the same difficulties. You can consider the assignment full assignment now for lesson 55. Had enough time to get it. Yeah, no more grades. Next time we'll go through that. But you got all break to do it. Well, I hope you don't do it over break. I want you to really get a good break. Here's another one.